Fish said with a dismissive gesture. Bress acts only when it is in his interest to do so.
I understand that, but why send Bress? Is he to kill me?
I do not know. He certainly cannot be coming to outwit you. Truthfully, Druid, I hope the two of you do come to blows and you defeat him. He does not respect the forest as he should.
I offered no response, and Flitish seemed content to let me consider what she had said. She sipped her smoothie and reached down to give Oberon a friendly scratch behind the ears. His tail sprang to life and quickly thumped against the legs of our chairs. I could hear him begin to tell her of the sport to be had at Papago Park, and I smiled at the way he always kept his goals firmly in mind, the mark of a true hunter.
"There are desert bighorn sheep in the hills there. Have you ever hunted them?"
Flitish told him no, she had never hunted sheep at all. They were herd animals that offered no sport.
"These are not regular sheep. They are larger, they are brown, and they move very fast among the rocks. We have yet to corner one, though we have tried only a few times. I always enjoy the hunt anyway."
"Does your hound jest with me, Atticus?"
Flitish raised her eyes to mine, and a note of contempt crept into her voice.
"You were unable to bring down a sheep?"
"Oberon never jests about hunting," I said. "Desert bighorns are nothing like the sheep you are used to. They are significant game, especially in the Papago Hills. Treacherous rocks there."
"Why have I never heard of these creatures?"
I shrugged. "They are native to this area. There are several desert creatures you would probably enjoy hunting here." Flitish sat back in her chair, frowning, and took another sip of her smoothie as if it were an elixir to cure cognitive dissonance. She stared for a few moments at the low-hanging branches of my mesquite tree, which were swaying gently in a whisper of desert wind. Then, without warning, her face exploded in a smile and she laughed in delight. I would almost call it a giggle, but that would be beneath the dignity of a goddess.
"Something new," she gushed. "Do you know how long it has been since I have hunted anything new? Why, it has been centuries, Druid, millennia even."
I raised my glass. "To novelty," I said. It was a highly prized commodity amongst the long-lived. She clinked her glass against mine, and we drank contentedly and shared silence for a while, until she asked when we could begin the hunt. "Not until a few hours after nightfall," I said. "We must wait for the park to close and the mortals to retire for the night." Flitish arched an eyebrow at me.
"And how shall we spend the intervening hours, Atticus?"
"You are my guest. We may spend it however you wish." Her eyes appraised me and I pretended not to notice, keeping my gaze locked on my bicycle, still lying in the street.
"You appear to be in the summertime of youth," she said.
"My thanks. You look well as always."
"I am curious to discover if you still have the endurance of the Fianna, or if you are hiding a decrepitude and softness most unbecoming a Celt."
I stood up and offered her my right hand. "My left arm was injured earlier this afternoon and is still not fully healed. However, if you will follow me and assist in mending it, I will do my best to satisfy your curiosity." The corner of her mouth quirked up at the edge, and her eyes smoldered as she placed her hand in mine and rose. I locked my eyes on hers and didn't let go of her hand as we returned inside and went to the bedroom. I figured, to hell with the bike. I'd probably feel like jogging to work in the morning anyway. Chapter 5. Pillow talk in the modern era often involves the sharing of childhood stories, or perhaps an exchange of dream vacations. One of my recent partners, a lovely lass named Jessie with a tattoo of a Tinkerbell on her right shoulder blade, about as far from a real fairy as one can get, had wanted to discuss a science fiction television program, Battlestar Galactica, as a political allegory for the Bush years. When I confessed I had no knowledge of the show nor any interest in getting to know it or anything about American politics, she called me a frackin' Cylon and stormed out of the house, leaving me confused yet somewhat relieved. Flitish, on the other hand, wanted to talk about the ancient sword of Manannan MacLear, called Fragara, the Answerer. It kind of killed the afterglow for me, and I felt myself growing irritated.
"Do you still have it?"
she asked. and as soon as she did, I suspected that the entire visit, even the conjugal part, had been planned just so she could discover the answer. I had flat-out lied to the lesser Fae who'd attacked me earlier, but I didn't feel safe doing the same to Flittish. "Angus Ogg certainly thinks so," I hedged.
"That is no answer."
"That is because I have reason to be cautious, or even paranoid, where that subject is concerned. I mean you no disrespect." She eyed me steadily for a full 5 minutes, trying to get me to talk by merely remaining silent. It works well on most humans, but the druids taught that technique to the Tuatha De Danann before I was born, so I kept my smile on the inside and waited for her next move. I busied myself in the interim by trying to find patterns in the popcorn ceiling and idly stroking her right arm, which was tattooed like mine, ready to draw the earth's power with an effort of will. I found a woodpecker, a snow leopard, and what might have been the snarling face of Randy Johnson throwing a slider before she spoke again.
"Tell me the story of how you came to possess it in the first place, then," she finally said. "The legendary Fragara, the sword that can pierce any armor. I have heard several versions of it in Tir na n'Og, and I would like to hear you tell it."
It was an appeal to my vanity. She wanted me to lapse into braggadocio and get so carried away with my tale that I'd wind up blurting out, "It's in my garage," or "I sold it on eBay," or something similar. All right. I stole it in the Battle of Moylena, when Khan of the Hundred Battles was so bent on slaying Monuada during the night that he hardly cared what weapon he was holding in his hand. I raised my fist as if it grasped a sword. Khan was outnumbered, and he knew he'd have little chance of winning in a straight-up fight, so he decided to attack in the night to skew the odds in his favor. Gol Mac Morna and the rest of the Fianna refused to fight until the morning, citing something about honor, but I've never had much of that in the middle of a war. Being honorable is an excellent way to get yourself killed. Witness the British getting their hair lifted by this continent's natives in the 18th century because they refused to break their silly formations. Flittish grunted, then said,
"This was before Finn McCool led the Fianna."
"Oh, aye, well before. So, I slunk away from the Fianna's fires and went to join Khan in the slaughter. He was hacking his way amongst Mo Nuada's army, which was about 17,000 Gauls and 2,000 Spaniards, if you can believe it, when his hands, slick with the blood of his fallen enemies, slipped on the hilt of Fragara as he raised it for another blow, letting this magnificent sword sail behind him over his head to literally fall at my feet in the chaos of a night battle. Flittish snorted.
"I don't believe you. He simply dropped it?"
"Threw it would be more accurate." I raised my right hand. "Every word is true or I am the son of a goat. I picked it up, felt the magic thrumming through my arm, wrapped myself in mist, and exited the field with my prize, never to return until the time of Cormac McCart."
"Nay, they did not let you simply exit with Fragara."
"You're right," I chuckled. "There was a bit more to it than that. I thought you might enjoy the short version, though." Flittish seemed to seriously consider whether or not she had enjoyed it.
"I appreciated the denial of expectations. It is similar to when prey refuses to behave in standard fashion, making the hunt more interesting. But I know that you have skipped many details, and it already differs from what I have heard, so now I must know it all. Tell me the longer version."
"Wait, what did you hear in Tir na n'Og? The short version?"
"I heard that you stole it from Khan through chicanery and guile. In some tales you put him to sleep through use of a potion. In others you switch swords with him using an illusion. You come across as little more than a scheming, cowardly footpad."
"How delightful. All right, then. I think perhaps it is crucial to know my state of mind leading up to the point where the sword dropped at my feet, for that is truly how it happened. Night battles are ridiculously crazy. I wasn't sure that I was always facing people from the opposing army, you know? The only illumination saving it from being black as tar was the pale glow of a crescent moon, the stars, and a few distant campfires. I may have accidentally killed a man or two on my own side, and I was paranoid about being cut down in a similar accident. So I was thinking, this is absurdly dangerous. Why am I doing this, and why am I here? and the answer that I came up with was this. We were all killing one another in the middle of the night because Khan had a magic sword given to him by Lu Lawada of the Tuatha De Danann. Fragara's power had allowed him to conquer most of Ireland. Great as he was, he could not have done it without that sword. Khan would have never had the stones to attack Mo Nuada without it. Everyone who died in the battle to that point had done so because a single sword gave one man in power the lust for more. And as I maniacally hewed down whoever faced me, I realized that even as we fought for Khan, Khan was fighting for the Tuatha De, manipulated by Lu and his cronies as sure as a tree drinks water.
I remember this now, Flitish said. I stood apart because I had never had much interest in human affairs outside the forest. But Lu was very interested, and Angus Og even more so.
Aye. I think they wanted to bring peace to Ireland at the point of a sword. They encouraged Khan to do what he did, and all the high kings after him. And perhaps it would have been the best thing for Ireland. I don't know. What bothered me is that the Tuatha De were manipulating human events, when they were supposed to have been removed from them centuries before.
Meddlesome, are we? Flitish grinned sardonically.
In that particular case, you were. I was mentally cataloging which of you were on Khan's side and who was on Mo Nuada's when the sword fell at my feet. I knew immediately what it was. I could feel its power pulsing through the ground, calling to me. And that's when I heard a voice in my head, already half expected, telling me to pick it up and exit the field. Pick it up, the voice said, and I would be protected.
Whose voice was it? Flitish asked.
Cannot you guess?
The Morrigan, she whispered.
Yes, indeed, the old battle crow herself. I would not be surprised if she had something to do with it slipping from Khan's grasp in the first place. So I picked it up. When you're in the middle of a killing field and the fucking chooser of the slain tells you to do something, you do it. But of course, there were many agents, human and immortal, who objected to this.
Khan came after you?
Not personally. He was too busy fighting for his life with a normal sword he'd snatched from a corpse. He was in the very thick of the melee, and thus he sent some of his chiefs behind him to find Fragara. What they found was a druid holding his sword and not particularly anxious to surrender it. In fact, they found me trying to summon mist to cloak my escape.
Only trying?
Flitish raised an eyebrow. I noticed that she had a few freckles underneath her eyes, high on her cheeks. She was comfortably pink all over and slightly bronzed from the sun, not the marble white of the Morrigan. It was rather difficult to concentrate. Angus Og and Lu were in my head telling me to return the sword to Khan or die, and the Morrigan was telling me I would die if I gave it back. I said to the Morrigan that I wanted to keep Fragara for my own, to which Angus Og and Lu both shouted no, so of course the Morrigan instantly agreed. Flitish laughed.
You played them against one another. This is utterly delicious.
But wait, it gets tastier. The Morrigan shielded my mind from Angus Og and Lu, and just in time. Khan's lieutenants tried to slay me and quickly discovered that while Fragara was a great sword in Khan's hand, it was a terrible sword in mine. They all shouted traitor before they dropped in the mud, however, and I abruptly found myself surrounded by hostiles. Hostiles egged on to kill me by Angus Og and Lu, no doubt. The Morrigan suggested to me that the best way out would be through Mo Nuada's army. Charging in that direction, I whirled Fragara around me with all the strength the druid could muster from the earth, cleaving bodies in two and shearing anonymous torsos from their trunks. The flying halves of men bowled whole men over, and fountains of blood showered upon my erstwhile comrades. I eventually reached Mo Nuada's Spaniards, who parted for me like the Red Sea for Moses.
For whom?
I beg your pardon. I was alluding to a figure from the Torah, who escaped an Egyptian army by appealing to the god Yahweh for aid. Yahweh parted the Red Sea for Moses and his Jewish friends to escape, and when the Pharaoh's army tried to follow, the Red Sea fell upon them, drowning them all. And so it was when Khan's men tried to pursue me. The Spaniards closed ranks and thwarted them, and I ran freely to the other side of the field, thanking the Morrigan for her assistance. But that's when Angus Og decided to take a very personal hand in the matter. He appeared before me in the flesh and demanded that I return the sword.
You had better not be jesting with me now,
Flittish said. I assure you I remember it very clearly. He was outfitted in some stunning bronze armor etched with lovely bindings and dark blue pauldrons and bracers. Do you remember seeing it?
Long ago, yes, but that proves nothing.
Confirm it all with the Morrigan. For just as Angus and I were about to come to blows, she alighted on my shoulder as the battle crow and told Angus to back the fuck off.
She actually said that?
No, I grinned. I confess that was a bardic embellishment. She said I was under her personal protection, and by threatening me, he placed himself in mortal peril. Flittish clapped her hands in delight.
Oh, I bet he nearly shetkine.
That made me laugh. I hadn't heard that expression in a long, long time. I refrained from telling her that the modern expression would be, he had a cow, because I liked the original better. Yes, the kine he nearly shat would have fed several clans.
What did Angus do then?
He protested that the Morrigan had gone too far and interfered beyond her compass. She replied that the battlefield was precisely her province and she could do as she wished. She tried to make him feel better by guaranteeing that Khan would survive the night and even win the battle. He accepted these concessions as his due, but couldn't leave without threatening me personally. He glared at me with those flat black eyes and promised me a short, miserable life. And I'm grateful for that, because the Morrigan has tried to make it the opposite as much as possible. You may enjoy this victory now, Druid, he said, but you will never know peace. My agents, both human and fey, will hound you until you die. Always you will have to look over your shoulder for the knife at your back. So swears Angus, blah, blah, blah.
Where did you go? Flittish asked.
At the Morrigan's suggestion, I left Ireland to make it tougher for Angus to kill me. But the bloody Romans were everywhere, and they weren't friendly to druids. It was the reign of Antoninus Pius, so I had to travel east of the Rhine to escape them and join the Germanic tribes holding the line there. I fathered a child, picked up a language or two, and waited a couple generations for people in Ireland to forget about me. By stealing Fragora, I had ensured plenty more battles and horrible bloody deaths. Khan wasn't able to fully unite all the tribes without Fragora to enforce his will, and Angus Og's dreams of some kind of Pax Ireland were ruined. Even though Khan won the battle and slew Mo Nuada, he had to settle for a patchwork of truces and marriages to keep the illusion of peace, and it all fell apart after his death. The Morrigan has used my name to goad Angus Og ever since, not that he needed it. After I bore witness to his cowering before her, there was nothing he wished more than to erase his humiliation by erasing me.
How long since you have wielded Fragora?
I will not say. The goddess's face fell a bit, clearly disappointed that her gambit had failed, and I grinned. But if you're wondering if I have kept up with my swordsmanship, the answer's yes.
Oh? And with whom do you spar out here? I would imagine that there are few mortals alive who are truly skilled with a blade anymore.
You imagine correctly. I spar with Leif Helgerson, an old Icelandic Viking.
You mean he can trace his lineage back to the Vikings?
No, I mean he really is a Viking. Came to this continent with Eric the Red. The brow of the goddess knitted in confusion. There were a few extremely long-lived mortals like me running around, but she thought she knew them all. I could tell she was reviewing them in her head, and when she failed to recall any Vikings, she said,
How is this possible? Has he made some sort of bargain with the Valkyries?
No, he's a vampire. Flittish hissed and leapt out of bed, landing in a defensive fighting posture as if I was going to attack her. I very carefully did not move except to turn my head a little bit and admire her perfectly sculpted form. The last rays of the day's sun were filtering through the blinds, leaving soft striped shadows on her lightly tanned legs.
You dare consort with the undead?
She spat. I really hate that word, even though I occasionally catch myself using it. Ever since Romeo and Juliet, I am of Mercutio's mind when he takes issue with Tybalt's suggestion that he consorts with Romeo. To mask my irritation, I grinned and tried to affect an Elizabethan accent.
Zounds, consort! Wouldst thou make me a minstrel? I speak not of minstrels, she scowled. I speak of evil.
Oh well, not a fan of the bard, then. Your pardon, Flitish. I was alluding to an old play by Master Shakespeare. But I can see you are in no mood for light banter. I would not say that I consort with the undead, for that would imply a relationship beyond what is minimally necessary for business. I merely employ Mr. Helgerson. He's my attorney.
You are telling me that your lawyer is a blood-sucking vampire?
Yes. He is an associate at the firm of Magnuson and Hauk. Hauk is also my attorney. He's also Icelandic, but he's a werewolf and takes care of clients during the day, and Helgerson obviously does his business after sunset.
Associating with a member of the pack I can understand, and even approve, but frolicking with the undead, that is taboo.
And a wiser taboo has never been enforced by any culture. But I have never frolicked with him, and have no plans to do so. Leif is not the frolicking type. I merely use his legal services and occasionally spar with him because he is the finest swordsman available in the area, and the fastest as well.
Why does the pack member work with the vampire? He should have killed the foul creature on sight.
I shrugged. We're not in the old world anymore. This is a new age and a new place, and they both happen to have a common enemy. Flitish cocked her head sideways and waited for me to name said enemy. And that would be Thor, the Norse god of thunder.
Oh, Flitish relaxed somewhat. I can understand that, then. He could make a salamander team up with a siren. What did he do to them?
Helgerson won't tell me, but it must have been bad. His fangs pop out if you just say Thor aloud, and he hunts carpenters simply because they use hammers. As far as Magnuson and Hauk go, Thor killed some of their pack members 10 or so years ago.
This Magnuson is a werewolf, too?
Aye, he's the Alpha. Hauk is his second.
Did Thor have cause to attack them?
Hauk says they were on holiday in the old forests of Norway, and it was nothing more than a capricious whim on Thor's part. 8 precisely aimed lightning strikes out of a sky that had been clear moments before. Couldn't possibly have been a freak occurrence. Silver isn't the only thing that can kill werewolves. Humans simply don't have access to weapons like bolts of lightning, which fry critters before they can heal. Flitish was silent for a time and regarded me intensely.
This desert seems to attract an unusual collection of beings.
I merely shrugged again and said, It is a good place to hide. No easy access from the Fey Plains, as you know. No gods stomping about, besides Coyote and the occasional visitor like yourself.
Who is Coyote?
He's a trickster god of the natives. There are several versions of him running around all over the continent. He's a nice lad. Just don't make any wagers with him.
Isn't the Christian god prominent here?
The Christians have such muddled ideas of him that he usually can't take shape beyond the crucifix form, and that isn't much fun, so he rarely bothers. Mary will appear more often, though, and she can do some pretty awesome stuff if she feels like it. Mostly she sits around looking beatific and full of grace. Keeps calling me child, even though I'm older than she is. Flitish smiled and crawled back into bed with me, vampires forgotten.
When were you born, Druid? You were already old for a mortal when first I met you.
I was born in the time of King Conor O'More, who reigned for 70 years. I was nearly 200 when I stole Frogora. She threw a leg across my body and then sat up so that she knelt astride me.
Angus Og thinks Frogora is rightfully his.
Her fingers began to trace curling patterns on my chest, and I stopped her by covering her hand with mine, with seeming affection. It wouldn't do to have her put a binding on me. Not that I thought she would. It was merely my customary paranoia. The people here, I said, have a saying. Possession is 9/10 of the law, and I've possessed it for far longer than any other being, including Mananon MacLear.
Angus Og cares nothing for mortal sayings. He thinks you have stolen his birthright, and that is all that matters to him.
His birthright? Mananon is his cousin, not his father. It's not like I stole his personal family heirloom. Besides, if it truly mattered to him, then he would have come to get it himself by now.
You have not stayed long enough in one place to make it practicable.
I looked at her with raised eyebrows. Is that all it takes to finally make this end? Just stay still?
I would think so. He will send surrogates after you first, but if you defeat them, he will eventually have no option but to come after you himself.
He would be pronounced a coward otherwise and banished from Tir na n'Og. I will stay still then, I said, and smiled up at her. But you can move if you like. May I suggest a gentle rocking motion? Chapter 6. Located just north of the Phoenix Zoo, Papago Park is an odd formation of isolated hills surrounded by teddy bear cholla, creosote, and saguaro. The hills are steep red rock and riddled with holes, 15-million-year-old remnants of ancient mudflows that petrified and eroded over the ages. Now the hills are playgrounds for children in one part of the park, a challenging day climb in some others, and in a fenced-off area on zoo property, home to a score of bighorn sheep. These last can be viewed, occasionally if they deign to show themselves, from a part of the zoo called the Arizona Trail. But even then the viewers may be forced to use binoculars to see them well, because it is not an exhibit so much as a tiny preserve, where the sheep are left largely to themselves and undisturbed. That is, until Oberon and I started terrorizing them. When I hunted with Oberon, I took the form of a wolfhound with a red coat shot through with streaks of white, slightly taller in shoulder than Oberon, and with dark markings on the right side reminiscent of my tattoos. If I had gone out there with a bow and let Oberon flush them for me, it would have been far simpler but far less satisfying for both of us. Oberon wanted to bring them down in the old way, never mind that wolfhounds were bred to chase down wolves in the forest and take out charioteers on the battle plain, not leap around rocky hills after nimble-footed rams. The reason the sheep were so hard to bring down was that the terrain was steep, unkind to our paws, and a tumble from the rocks would probably land us in a cactus. And anyone who's ever tried to tangle with a teddy bear cholla knows there's a whole lot more bear than teddy to it. The conditions would simply not let us open up full bore and catch up to them. When we got to the park, Oberon was ready to kill just about anything that moved. He'd been trying to intimidate Flitish's stags, and found that they were not scared of him in the least, and it was practically making him rabid. I had overheard snatches of their conversation as we rode along in Flitish's chariot.
"If you were not under the goddess's protection, I would have you for supper," he told them.
"Maybe if you had 20 friends or so," they taunted him. "A single puppy would never trouble us."
"Oh-ho.
You would not be so bold if the goddess were not here."
"Is that so? She leaves us alone for long periods of time, staked to a small area. Try to take us then and see what happens, runt."
Oberon growled at them and bared his teeth, and I told him to hush, doing my best to hide my amusement. Oh, was he ever mad? Calling a giant like him a runt? They really knew how to push a dog's buttons. Flitish asked me where she should park her chariot, and I suggested she leave it by Hunt's tomb, a small white pyramid incongruously erected on one of the hills as the final resting place of Arizona's first governor. It was fenced off from the rest of the park, but the stags simply leapt over it, jerking the chariot abruptly behind, but landing gracefully on the other side through some of Flitish's magic.
"Can you jump like that, little doggy?"
one of the stags teased. Oberon simply growled in response, far past the point of vocalizing. We got out of the chariot, and he barked at them once before I brought him to heel. "We're after sheep tonight," I reminded him.
"Let's go then,"
he replied as the stags snorted their laughter.
"Get yourself ready, druid,"
Flitish said as she slung her quiver over her head. And so I cleared my head and summoned power through the tattoo that tied me to the earth, drawing strength up from the desert. I fell down on all fours as I bound myself to the shape of a hound. A druid's therianthropy is nothing like the change of a werewolf, save in the sense that both are magical. One major difference is that I can change shape, or not, at will, regardless of the time of day or the phase of the moon. Another is that it's fairly painless, unlike lycanthropy. Yet another is that I can transform into different animals, albeit a limited few. In practice, I do not stay for long periods in animal form, for psychological reasons. While I can eat anything the animal would eat and not suffer physically from it, mentally I have difficulty choking down whole mice when I'm an owl, or eating raw venison as a hound. We had taken down a doe in the Kaibab forest a couple of weeks ago, and once she was down, I had walked off and waited until Oberon had had his fill. So these hunts were for Oberon more than for me. I just enjoyed the chase and that warm fuzzy feeling you get when you know you're making someone happy. But something was different this time when I changed to hound form. My mind felt befuddled, and I was more than a little bloodthirsty. I smelled the sheep scent on the night air, and the nearness of the stags, but instead of accepting this input coolly, I became ravenous and started drooling a bit. It was wrong, and I should have changed back right then. Flittish strode to the fence and ripped a section of it from the ground with a single hand, whistling once and gesturing for us to run through. We scampered underneath the links and headed for the hills we had hunted before, keeping silent so as not to alert the sheep too early that we were coming for them. There was another fence to negotiate to get into the preserve portion of the park, and Flittish obliged us there as well.
"Now go, my hounds,"
she said as she ripped up another section of fence, and as she said it, I felt as if I was her hound, not a druid anymore, not even human anymore, but part of a pack.
"Flush a ram out of the hills and bring him to my bow."
And then we were off, running faster than we ever had before, dodging cacti in the weak starlight of a city sky, and I was only dimly aware that there was magic at work here that was not my own. The cold iron amulet necklace, now shrunk about my neck like a collar, should protect me from it if it was sinister, so I did not worry. It didn't take us long to find the sheep. They were bedded down in a tangle of creosote, but they heard us scrabbling in the gravel of the desert floor and were already leaping up a nearly vertical hillside when we first laid eyes on them. Our legs spasmed as we tried to make that first leap up to the beginnings of a slope. I made it to a narrow precipice, though barely, but Oberon fell short and tumbled backward into the dirt with a woof of breath.
"Go around the base and wait," I said to him. "I will chase them over to you."
"Very well," he agreed. "Cunning is better than running."
I kept my eyes on the retreating flanks of the sheep ahead of me and kept pumping my legs up the hill. Incredibly, I seemed to be gaining ground on them, and I felt so triumphant about it that I let loose with a few barks to scare them stupid. But they were built to negotiate those hills with ease, and I was not, and eventually I lost some ground as I had to scramble for footholds and find better places to jump up. When they disappeared over the peak and were headed down the other side, I started barking again to make sure they knew I was close behind and there was no time to stop. I wanted them to head straight for Oberon. I had no way of knowing precisely where he was waiting, of course, but hopefully my barking would give him an idea of where we were headed. Going down was much more treacherous than going up. The way the shadows fell, it was difficult to tell if the next step was a foot down or a fathom, but the pale flanks bobbing up and down ahead of me in soft, night-blue streaks gave me a good idea of what to expect. They were headed almost due south, and I heard nothing beyond their hooves clattering amongst the rocks and my own panting and barking. If Oberon and Flittish were waiting ahead, they were being careful not to reveal their positions. I kept barking, though it was more to drown out any small noises Oberon might make than any enthusiasm I had for closing the gap between us. I fetched up at a precipice and saw that I would have to travel around to the west a bit before I could find a way down, and with every second the sheep got farther away. So I remained where I was and watched, and sure enough, Oberon was hidden behind a creosote bush, not far from where the sheep finally came down off the hill. There was a gap of 50 yards or so before the next hill reared up out of the earth, with nothing but sparse desert plants in the way. Oberon cut off their approach to the next hill, and I was barking behind them, so the sheep turned east up the pass between the hills. Once they silhouetted themselves against the sky, an arrow knocked one off its feet and sent it tumbling, bleeding to its doom as its fellows fled. Oberon closed on it to finish it off, but there was no need. Flittish's arrow had found its heart, and she would doubtless appear momentarily to claim her kill. I began to work my way down the hill, wondering if she would be satisfied. The hunt had not lasted long. We had flushed them too perfectly, owing perhaps to our recent visits and familiarity with the terrain. But it seemed those recent visits had not gone unnoticed, unfortunately. As I reached the site of the kill, where Flittish was already gutting the animal and Oberon was standing nearby, a park ranger suddenly appeared, holding a flashlight and a gun. He demanded loudly that we freeze as he blinded us with a halogen glare. We couldn't have been more startled. He should not have been able to sneak up on any of us, much less all three. But it is not wise to surprise one of the Tuatha De Danann. Flittish whipped her knife out of its sheath and threw it to the left of the flashlight before I had even finished turning my head toward the ranger. She had not aimed or even looked, so the knife didn't kill him. It sank into his left shoulder and caused him to cry out and drop his flashlight, which would make it harder for him to aim that gun if he felt like shooting. It turned out he did. A few shots thundered in the night, and I felt one bullet whip over my spine and heard another smack into a barrel cactus to my left. Flittish grunted as she took a slug in the arm, then roared in outrage as she realized what had happened.
"Kill him!"
she shrieked, and I unthinkingly leapt to obey, as did Oberon. But unlike Oberon, I managed an independent thought after the first couple of steps, and that stopped me. Killing a ranger would bring the law down upon us, perhaps forcing us to flee, and I did not want to leave Arizona. I changed back to my human form, and immediately the fog lifted from my mind. Flittish had been controlling me as a hound, just as she was controlling Oberon, just as she could control all animals. Unable to resist without the protection of cold iron, Oberon had not stopped, and now he had the man flat on his back, screaming. I tried to call him off, but it was no use with Flittish binding him to her will. I could not even feel his mental presence as I normally could.
"Flittish, release my hound now!"
I snapped, and the man's scream stopped. But it was already too late. Without ceremony, without any dramatic growls or shivering violins, my hound had torn out the poor man's throat. Oberon's thoughts returned, and a flood of questions filled my mind.
"Atticus, what happened? I taste blood. Who is this man? Where am I? I thought we were supposed to be hunting sheep. I didn't do this, did I?"
"Step away from him and I'll explain in a moment," I said. When one has seen as much death as Flittish and I have, there are no expressions of disbelief at a person's sudden end. There's no gibbering, no wailing, no tearing of hair. There is only a cool assessment of the consequences. But if the consequences are dire, then a display of emotion is allowed.
"That was not necessary,"
I shouted, but carefully kept my eyes on the corpse.
"We could have disarmed him. His death will cause me and my hound much trouble."
"I do not see how," Flittish replied. "We can simply dispose of the body."
"That is not so simple as it used to be. They will find it eventually, and when they do, they will find canine DNA in the wounds."
"You speak of the mortals?" the huntress asked. "What does one do when one needs to pray to the gods for patience, but a god is causing the need for patience?"
"Yes, the mortals," I spat.
"What is this DNA you speak of?" I ground my teeth and heard the short yips of coyote on the thin desert air. He was laughing at me. "Never mind." "I think it well he is dead, Druid. He shot me and tried to shoot you, and he also surprised me, which should not have been possible." I had to admit that piqued my curiosity. I stepped closer to the body and warned Oberon off.
"Atticus,"
he practically whined.
"Are you angry with me?"
"No, Oberon," I said. "You didn't do this. Flittish did. She used your teeth as a weapon, just as she would use a knife or her bow." He whined in earnest.
"I feel terrible. Sick. Oh."
He coughed and hacked, vomiting onto the dry, rocky soil. I crouched down to take a closer look at the ranger. He was a young Latino with a wispy mustache and a pair of thick lips. His aura was already gone, his soul traveling elsewhere, but when I used one of my charms to check out the magical spectrum, I saw traces of druidry in a diamond stud in his left ear. That set off alarms. I rose and gestured at the man. "Flittish, his earring is magical. Can you determine its purpose, or perhaps its origin?" Its origin was clear to me, but the knots in these particular bindings were unfamiliar. My query was a sort of test. If Flittish confirmed their druidic origin, and even recognized their purpose, she was not playing double. If she tried to tell me it was Woden, however, or something else completely different, then she was on some other side than mine. Flittish's boots crunched toward me, her trophy ram and wounded arm forgotten. She squatted next to the ranger's head and examined the earring.
"Ah, yes, I recognize these bindings. It's not the sort of thing the lesser fae can do. This man was under the control of the Tuatha De."
"That is enough for me," I said, satisfied she was telling the truth. "I'm sure it was Angus Ogg himself. He He gave the man a cloaking spell and then broke it abruptly as he was about to speak, ensuring our surprise and the man's death. It is the sort of puppetry Angus enjoys. I did not mention that Flitish seemed to enjoy it, too. I felt like joining Oberon in a nice cathartic vomit, utterly repulsed by these beings who robbed creatures of their own free will. I had looked up Angus Og on the internet once to see if the mortals had a clue about his true nature. They describe him as a god of love and beauty, with four birds following him about, representing his kisses or some such nonsense. Who would tolerate four birds flapping about his head, constantly letting loose their bowels and screeching? Not the Angus I know. But some accounts provide a better picture of his character by also telling of his deeds, such as taking his father's house from him by trickery and slaying both his stepfather and his foster mother, or the time he left a girl who was hopelessly in love with him and who died of grief a few weeks later. That's more the kind of man we're talking about. No, the Celtic god of love isn't a cherub with cute little wings, nor is he a siren born of the sea in a giant clamshell. He is not benevolent or merciful, or even inclined to be nice on a regular basis. Though it pains me to think of it because of what it says about my people, our god of love is a ruthless seeker of conquest, wholly self-serving, and more than a little vindictive. As if to punctuate that thought, emergency sirens began to wail in the night.
"That noise is used by mortal law enforcement, is it not?" Flitish asked.
"Aye, it is."
"Do you think it probable that they are headed here?"
"Of course. Angus sent this man to die," I said, waving at the ranger, "and he wants us to be inconvenienced as much as possible." The chance that the police would not know precisely where in the park to look for us was as close to zero as I could imagine.
"And I suppose," she said with asperity, "that you would not want me to kill the mortal authorities so that I can take time to harvest my trophy."
She was not joking. She really would have killed them without compunction. From her tone, it was clear that I should be grateful to her for recognizing that I might have a different set of priorities. "You suppose correctly, Flitish. Living as I do amongst the mortals, I am subject to their laws and do not wish to draw undue attention to myself." The huntress sighed in exasperation.
"Then we must hurry. The best I can do is to have the earth swallow him," she said, yanking her knife out of the dead man's shoulder.
I shook my head. "The police will have him out of the ground again as soon as we leave. But go ahead, since it's the best we can do. It may contaminate the evidence somewhat." Flitish spoke some of the old tongue, and the skin around her tattoos whitened briefly as she drew power from the land. She frowned a bit. There was not as much to be had out here as in the old world, and it cost her more effort than it should have. But she waved her fingers, said,
"Askill,"
and the dirt beneath the ranger obeyed. First the surface gravel began to skitter away from him, then the crust began to cave and ripple beneath him, and he sank. Once he was only a couple of feet below the surface, Flitish waved her fingers in the opposite direction, muttered,
"Dune,"
and the earth closed over him. It was magic I could have performed myself, albeit not so quickly. There was nothing subtle about it, though. The earth looked churned up and disturbed, and the police would have little trouble deciding where to look for a freshly killed body. The sirens were close now.
"Back to the chariot," she said,
and I nodded and set off at a ground-eating pace, calling Oberon to follow. Flitish paused only to collect her bow and pull her arrow out of the ram. Then she caught up and ran with us. The sirens stopped, and we heard the dull whump of car doors slamming to the south as we reached her chariot. If they had a guide, and I had no doubt they did, the police would reach the body in minutes.
"Why isn't your tail wagging, puppy?"
one of the stags said.
"Were you a bad doggy?" the other chimed in.
Before I could, Flitish told them to shut up, and thankfully Oberon bit back any response he would have given. Flitish cast invisibility on us, a wonderful trick that, and we hoofed it out of there without delay. The goddess of the hunt was seething.
"My first new hunt in an age of man," she said through gritted teeth, "and it was ruined by Angus Og. Well, I will be avenged. The huntress can be patient."
"You're better adjusted than I am," I said, though I thought her a dangerous sociopath. "I'm about out of patience." Chapter 7. With much apologizing and simultaneous thanks for the gift of her company, I suggested to Flitish once I returned home that if I were to be attacked shortly by a party of firbolgs, I had much to do in the way of preparation. She was only too happy to take the hint and her leave.
If you prevail, Druid, perhaps we can hunt at leisure in the near future. You have my blessing.
She gave Oberon an affectionate pat on the head, from which he tried to recoil, bade us both farewell, then winked out of sight and returned to her chariot. We may have had her blessing, but we wouldn't have her bow at our back. She could not afford to be seen taking my side against the Tuatha De Danann. I expelled a deep breath, releasing some of the tension her mere presence had caused, and sank into a chair by my kitchen table. Oberon approached me, head down, tail between his legs.
"Atticus, I'm sorry," he said.
"It was not your fault," I reminded him. "She used you like a weapon, and Angus Og wanted that man to be killed. But now you and I must face the consequences."
"Because I killed him,"
Oberon said. "Flitish made you kill him. Nevertheless, that means that you will be killed in turn if the police figure out you're the one who did it."
"I don't even remember doing it."
"I know, and that is why we will never hunt with her again. She had a strong influence on me as well, and I did not like being under her control even a little bit."
"You never hunted with her before?"
"Never in animal form. I hunted with her for a good while in the Ukraine once. She helped me out with my archery on horseback. It's bloody tough, I'll tell you, but Genghis Khan's hordes could do it, so of course I had to learn."
"I have no idea what you're talking about right now."
"Never mind. Listen, we have to get you cleaned up, into the bath."
"Can I just roll around in the dirt?"
"No, we need to get you super clean. Any blood found on you will automatically get you killed at this point."
"You won't let them find me, though, right?"
"Not if I can help it, Oberon. Come on, let's go." I rose from my chair, and Oberon began to trot in front of me down the hall to the bathroom, his tail wagging again.
"Will you tell me about Genghis Khan's whores while I'm in the bath?"
"Hordes, not whores. He had both, though, now that you mention it."
"Sounds like he was a busy guy."
"You have no idea." We had a good time with the suds and the short version of Khan's empire, after which I had to see to my preparations for the firbolgs, the full extent of which was nothing more than a good night's sleep. They would not attack me in my home, figuring it would be too well protected, and it was. They would wait for me to set foot off my property, and then they would gang up on me like a bunch of schoolyard bullies. So I relaxed and got my beauty rest. In the morning, I calmly made myself an omelet with cheese and chives, poured some Tabasco on it, and nibbled on a piece of whole wheat toast. I cooked up some sausages, too, but most of them went to Oberon. I made us a pot of coffee to wash it down, some freshly ground organic stuff from Central America. I usually take mine black, but Oberon likes it with Irish cream coffee mate and cooled down with a few ice cubes.
"Did Genghis Khan take his coffee black?"
Oberon asked me. After my bath time story, he wanted to be the Genghis Khan of dogs. He wanted a harem full of French poodles, all of whom were named either Fifi or Bambi. It was an amusing habit of his. Oberon had, in the past, wanted to be Vlad the Impaler, Joan of Arc, Bertrand Russell, and any other historical figure I had recently told him about while he was getting a thorough cleansing. His Liberace period had been particularly good for my soul. You haven't lived until you've seen an Irish wolfhound parading around in rhinestone-studded gold lamé. "He didn't drink coffee," I replied. "Genghis Khan was more of a tea man. Or yak milk. Coffee really wasn't around in his time."
"May I have some tea, then?"
"Of course. I'll ice it for you after it brews so you won't burn your tongue." After I cleared away the dishes and Oberon Khan had enjoyed his tea, it was time to make myself a target. I strode out to my backyard, barefoot, and told Oberon to go into sentinel mode. I watered my herb garden from right to left, talking to the plants and encouraging them. The herbs grew in planter boxes around the circumference of my yard, all of which rested on shelves attached to my fence. Underneath these, I grew some vegetables in the actual earth of my backyard, leaving some real estate for Oberon to roll around on. The medicinal herbs took up most of the boxes, but I spared a few for culinary varieties. While this mundane chore was going on, I was using my connection to the earth to review my domestic defenses. Sending my awareness down through my tattoos, I looked for holes in my bindings,
anything the least bit out of the ordinary, to make sure that I was alone and unwatched. There was a cactus wren checking me out from high up in my neighbor's Palo Verde tree, but he flew off when I made a throwing motion with my arm, thereby showing that he was a normal bird and not someone's familiar. When I came to the last planter box on the left, I put down the watering can and shook my head. "There's never enough time," I said, and pulled the box of herbs off the shelf and upended it on the lawn. The smell of rich loam and compost wafted into my nostrils, and the sight of a long, narrow package wrapped tightly in oilskin greeted my eyes.
"Oh, look,"
I said in mock surprise. Oberon recognized my tone and didn't bother to turn his head.
"Somebody has hidden an ancient magical sword underneath my herbs. That's so silly."
This was my most vulnerable time, because while the sword's location was now revealed, there were three bindings and a cloak on the sword to prevent anyone, including me, from using it. The bindings were my own work, and it's pretty much all a druid can do. We bind elements together or unbind them. When I shapeshift, I am binding my spirit to an animal's form. Summoning mist or wind, that's a form of binding too, as is camouflaging myself or allowing Oberon to hear my thoughts. It is all possible because we are already bound with the natural world by living in it. We could not bind anything if the strings connecting us to all of nature were not already there. And because we see these connections and know that seemingly disparate elements can in fact be closely related, druids have a better grasp of divination than most other magical practitioners. Our knowledge of nature makes us superior brewers of medicines, poisons, and even potables. We're able to run tirelessly by drawing on the power of the earth, and we heal fairly quickly. We're useful to have around. But we don't shoot balls of fire out of our hands, or fly upon brooms, or make people's heads explode. That sort of magic is only possible through a radically different view of the world, and by binding one's spirit to extremely unsavory beings. The bindings on Fragara were simple but effective. One kept the oilskin sealed, one kept the sword in its scabbard, yet another prevented it from leaving the confines of my backyard. All of these could be undone with a bit of my blood and spit, fluids I don't give out for free. But the best spell currently resting on Fragara was a magical cloak around the whole thing, denying that there was anything magical about it in the slightest. Even though I knew my bindings were there, I could not detect them. And even though Fragara is one of the most powerful magical items ever created, and it should be practically humming with fey energies, it just lay there in front of me like a stage prop. I knew the cloak worked on the Tuatha De Danann too, because Flitish obviously had been unable to sense it during her visit. The cloak was a spell far beyond my abilities. Those kinds of spells are not in the druidic milieu. A friendly local witch named Radomiwa had cast it for me. And in return, I had hopped a plane to San Francisco, driven up to Mendocino, and shapeshifted into a sea otter. This allowed me to retrieve an ornate golden necklace set with several large rubies, which were clutched in the hand of a buried skeleton she had stunningly accurate information on. She seemed mightily pleased to receive it, but even with 2 millennia of arcane knowledge in my head, I had no idea what it signified. That's witches for you. What sealed the deal for me was that the cloak wouldn't come off without a generous donation of my tears. Those used to be almost impossible for me to summon, I admit, until I watched Field of Dreams. When Kevin Costner asks his dad at the end if he'd like to have a catch, I just completely lose my shit. Any guy who doesn't is either in mixed company when he sees it or was blessed with an unusually sensitive father. I blubber and sob like a jilted girl every time I watch that scene, or even when I think about it. My dad would never have played catch with me, never mind that he's been dead for more than 2,000 years and baseball hadn't been invented then. My dad's idea of bonding was throwing me in the tar pits to teach me a lesson, though I'm not sure what the lesson was, except to stay the hell away from Da. So if I ever think of a reason why the cloak should come off, all I will have to do is think of Kevin Costner and his chance to have a moment of peace with his dad, and the tears will flow like mountain springs. Bindings vanished with a drop of blood pricked from my finger and a bit of spit, I unwrapped the oilskin carefully to reveal a finely tooled brown leather scabbard, above which rose a golden guard and a hilt wrapped in strips of ancient rawhide, the grain long worn away. The blade was not suffused with the watery swirls of cooled steel. It was merely straight and chiseled and deadly in its purpose.
A long leather strap attached to the iron rings on the scabbard allowed me to sling the sword across my back, and I did so to serve as both a lure and promise of punishment to those who would take it from me. I drew it thinking I needed to inspect the blade, but in truth it was more to admire it. I knew already that it was pristine. There had been no water damage to the scabbard. The blade sung and sparkled in the sunlight, and I marveled again at the strength of the cloak. Even though I knew it was Fragorat in my hand, its weight and balance and familiar knotwork etchings on the blade greeting me like old friends, the pulse of magic I usually felt was absent. The Firbolgs would not believe I had Fragorat in hand until it cut through their armor and bones as if they were rice paper. "Come to heel, Oberon," I said aloud as I sheathed Fragorat and rose. "Warn me of any approach, but do not attack unless I give you express permission."
"I'm coming to the shop with you?"
he asked, his ears raised in query. "Aye. You need to remain at my side until this business is finished. Do I need to remind you not to sniff my customers' asses?"
"You just did. And very subtly, too, thank you very much."
I chuckled. "I apologize if I have offended Oberon Khan. It is the stress of a death sentence that makes me speak without thinking."
"I will overlook it this time,"
Oberon replied, his tail wagging in good humor. "I'm also going to cast camouflage on you," I said, "so that if you remain still, no tail wagging, no panting, no one will see you. Even when you move, you'll be difficult to see, but you'll be practically invisible when still."
"Why do I need to be invisible?"
"Because after last night, people may come hunting you, and because if fairies come hunting me, I want you to take them by surprise."
"That's not very sporting."
"It is fine to be sporting when we hunt. It is ridiculous to be sporting in war, and often fatal." I cast the spell on him that binds one's skin and hair pigments to the hues of the surroundings, and he shook as if he were wet.
"Hey, that tickles," he said.
"Good enough," I replied. He trotted next to me as I pedaled to work, his nails clicking on the asphalt of the street. Following the noise, all one could see was a sort of heat mirage, just a wavy fluidity to the air. The Widow McDonough was already out on her porch with her morning whiskey, and she waved to me as I rode by.
"Will you be coming by this afternoon, Atticus?"
she called. I quickly glanced at her lawn and saw that it was due to be mowed. Her grapefruit tree could use a trim as well.
"A bonny young lass like you need not ask a man twice," I shouted back, hoping her ancient ears understood me.
I gave a thumbs up to reinforce the message, just in case. When I got to the store, my only employee was already there. Saturday mornings were always busy and I needed the help. I switched to silent communication with Oberon as I opened the door. "Go lie down behind my apothecary counter and keep your ears open."
"Okay. What am I listening for exactly?"
"The approach of really heavy footsteps, the kind giants would make."
"Morning, Atticus,"
a bass voice rumbled in gnarly cheerfulness.
"Good morning, Perry," I replied. "You sound abnormally happy. People be on to you if you don't watch it."
A tall man of 22 years smiled back at me with recently bleached teeth. Perry Thomas had dark hair fastidiously groomed to look carelessly mussed, rectangular glasses with thick black rims, and a silver labret stud nestled like a pearl in the hair of his soul patch. He also had large silver gauges in both ears and a pale complexion that seemed to be the primary accessory for all goths. He was dressed entirely in black, of course, with a concert t-shirt of the psychobilly group Mad Marge and the Stonecutters, a studded belt, and skinny leg jeans that blossomed at the bottom into full-blown Doc Martens. Perry failed to notice Oberon padding right between us to take his appointed spot behind the counter.
"Yeah, I'm supposed to be jaded and mournful that the sun is shining, aren't I? Don't worry, I'll get into character once the store opens.
Hey, cool sword."
"Thanks."
I waited for him to ask me more about it, but Perry had apparently exhausted all he had to say on the subject. Young people can be so uncomplicated. I glanced at the clock behind my counter, 5 minutes to opening.
"All right, give me a chance to get some tea brewing, and then fire up the soundtrack and we'll get going. I want both registers working today."
I had my apothecary counter and tea station on the east wall, immediately to the left or south of the store entrance. Wood shelves behind the counter held jars and little drawers of bagged herbs, many of which came from my backyard garden, and I had a couple of hot plates back there to heat kettles of water. There was a small fridge for milk, a sink, and some teacups always being washed and dried. I had a few packages of cookies and muffins for sale, but the lion's share of my apothecary business was in medicinal teas and bulk herb sales. I'd built up a regular clientele amongst the local senior citizens who came in for a proprietary blended tea that eased their arthritis and gave them a boost of energy. I called it mobility. They felt about 10 years younger for about 10 hours afterward, and they blessed me for it, bought newspapers, and had their morning arguments about politics and young people at the 5 tables I had placed in front of the counter. One register was there, and one was in the back of the store, on the west side, to handle customers who just wanted something from the bookstore. My book inventory was basically an expanded collection of the religion and New Age shelves in Barnes & Noble, but I also had some serious magical texts behind glass on the north wall. Buddhas and incense and various busts of Hindu gods were sprinkled amongst the shelves. I would have put some crucifixes around, too, if there had been any demand for that sort of thing. But devout Christians tended to avoid my store for some reason. Celtic crosses were popular.